over the gate.
May it please the court, I'm Eric Langley on behalf of the petitioners. The petitioners are a group of electric utilities who are affected by an FCC pole attachments order that upends the principles of statutory construction and reverses field on well-settled agency precedent. This is a case about the Pole Attachments Act and the limits that that act places on the FCC's regulatory authority. The first issue that I want to address relates to the incumbent local exchange carriers, specifically whether the FCC even has jurisdiction to regulate the rates, terms, and conditions that incumbent local exchange carriers pay for electric utility poles. The Pole Attachments Act was first adopted in 1978 to address and to facilitate the deployment of cable television services. It was substantively amended in 1996 as part of the broader Telecommunications Act of 1996 to address and foster competition with what were then deemed to be the incumbent telephone companies. But those two events have something very important in common. Both were designed to and did address new entrants into the communications market. Now, the resolution of the issue of whether the FCC has jurisdiction to regulate ILEC attachments on electric utility poles turns on whether, for purposes of Section 224, which is the Pole Attachments Act, an incumbent local exchange carrier is a provider of telecommunications service. And the answer to that question is no. And we need look no further than Section 224A5 of the Act itself to know that, because Section 224A5 specifically incorporates by reference.
Quote what it says.
Section 224A5 says that the term telecommunications carrier, as used in this section, as defined in Section 153 of this title, does not include any incumbent local exchange carrier.
So every time we see telecommunications carrier,
it didn't say provider of telecommunications services.
But Section 153, subpart 44, which is specifically incorporated by reference, does.
What does it say?
It says that a telecommunications...
Now, tell us exactly what it says.
Telecommunications carrier means any provider of telecommunications services except aggregators.
But it does not say, for all purposes, telecommunications carrier equals provider of telecommunications services.
Mm-hmm. No, in Section 224...
There's no such equation.
In Section 224A5, we would submit that it does, because it...
How does that enhance the equation?
Because it incorporates...
Which didn't exist in 153.44.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How does that turn what was not an equation in 153.44 into an equation?
Because Section 153, subpart 44, means something very important for purposes of the Pole Attachments Act. And that is that telecommunications carrier is the equivalent of any provider.
It does not say that.
But Congress used the term means.
Used the term means.
In Section 153, subpart 44, to say telecommunications carrier means any provider of telecommunications
services.
Not
say the reverse.
Well, that's correct, but where the term and its definition are connected by the term means, that's an exhaustive term.
That just isn't true.
Well, there's Supreme Court authority that states that, and we've cited that authority in our brief. But the important part is that where the term and its definition are connected by the word means, they are interchangeable. And so for purposes of Section 224, telecommunications carrier and provider of telecommunications.
Counsel, if you had a sentence that said the word cat means any animal which has retractable claws, that doesn't mean that every animal is a cat. And that seems to be what you're arguing here.
If Congress wrote the statute that way and specifically incorporated that definition into another statute, it just might. And that's exactly what it means here. But there's also the
important... It is a possible meaning, but it certainly is not the case that every time you have subject, means, predicate nominative, which, then that doesn't mean that every predicate nominative is a subject. It makes it included. It doesn't make it equivalent.
Well, but Congress did not use the term includes providers of telecommunication services. This would be a different case.
It doesn't say the greater equals either, is the same as, or... But it has not created an absolute equivalency by that language.
Your Honor, we would submit that use of the term means does create that equivalency. If Congress had used the term includes, this would be a different case. But Congress used the term means.
Do you think the additional phrase, except that such terms, except, does that do any work for you or not?
It really doesn't affect this case at all. It creates some...
No, I know it doesn't affect aggregators.
Be careful.
I'm asking you whether this helps your argument or not.
Doesn't it help your argument?
Why does? Yeah, I don't understand that. I mean, I would have thought you'd say absolutely. Now, see, if you don't, I don't understand your argument. I thought your argument was that means any, and that's proven by the fact that it goes on and excludes something.
Well, that's right.
So now I am right?
You were always right. I just didn't see it.
Come on. You mean my hourly rate is now justified?
And more, Your Honor. In section 153, subpart 44, by in essence saying telecommunications carrier means any provider of telecommunication services except aggregators, we know that two things are excluded from the definition of provider of telecommunication services for the limited purposes of Section 224. One of them is aggregators, one of them is incumbent local exchange carriers. But the one that matters here is incumbent local exchange carriers.
Why does the statute use the different term with reference to the ILEX in the operative statute here?
I don't know the answer to that question, but probably because they mean exactly the same thing. Or
doesn't answer the question of why they didn't use exactly the same words if they mean exactly the same. Well, normally, you're talking about established principles of statutory construction a while ago, and normally if there's two different terms used in the same statute, we would think Congress meant two different things about them. Why would they use a different term here if they meant precisely the same thing?
I can't answer for Congress, but what I can say is that Congress said...
We'll have to, so help us here. What?
Because Congress said elsewhere that the two terms mean the same thing. Another important piece
doesn't
of...
Doesn't this all suggest that what we have here is an ambiguous statute?
Not at all, Your
Honor.
No?
I mean, we spent 15 minutes here trying to figure it out. We've got Congress using two different words, yet attempting to, according to you, to define one as meaning the other. And you can't answer Chief Judge Sentell's question about why Congress did that.
It's beginning to
sound to me like what we have here is an ambiguous statute.
We don't have an ambiguous statute, at least not on this point. And here's why.
Yeah.
Congress specifically incorporated Section 153, subpart 44. So we know that much. The other piece of this, going back to Judge Sentell's question, is that as part of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, there was a whole bunch of other stuff. The Pole Attachment Act amendments were just a narrow part of this. And in other places in the statute, Section 251, subpart B4, to be precise, Congress actually used the term provider of telecommunications services in connection with a separate and arguably redundant obligation on the part of incumbent local exchange carriers to allow access to their competitors on reasonable rates, terms, and conditions. So we think that the incorporation by reference in A5 standing alone is enough, but if it's not enough, we can also look at what Congress was trying to accomplish, which is congressional intent, and what they did elsewhere within the same act. But we don't even need to get there. The other part here is that in 1996, and by the way, it's the 1996 amendments that have even created the argument upon which the FCC has relied. Congress well understood the long-standing relationships between telephone companies and electric utilities, who jointly built out these networks across the country for the purposes of accommodating their respective facilities. If Congress had intended to upset that settled representation, it wouldn't have been a huge elephant hidden in a very small mouse hole. That would have been express. And we know from Supreme Court precedent that Congress does not hide elephants in mouse holes, but that's exactly what the commission is now contending. And by the way, when the commission was first implementing the 1996 amendments, they saw it the same way that we did. And they didn't say, well,
under Chevron, it's clear that they don't, the one commission is not locked into the interpretation of an ambiguous statute adopted by a previous commission, or even the same members a week earlier, for that matter.
That's correct, but that presumes that they had found the statute to be ambiguous, and they never did until the order under review. Well,
isn't it we, in the end, who decide whether it's ambiguous?
Yes. However, I think that what the FCC has previously said on this precise subject is telling. Where they have...
Didn't they say it was clear and unambiguous?
They never said it was clear and unambiguous. They never said...
So what they've not said on this subject is telling, too, isn't it?
Yes.
Also, if we think now, if we think the statute's clear, it doesn't really make any difference what the FCC said earlier, right?
That's correct.
They were just wrong.
That's right.
Okay.
But even if the court does somehow reach Chevron Step 2, we still think that the rules...
You say somehow, you're not really going to be surprised if we do, are you?
Your Honor, I will be incredibly surprised.
You wouldn't.
Even if the court does...
You didn't
does...
make it past the straight place test yourself on that when you were smiling and you said...
Well,
that.
Nothing surprises me anymore, but we feel really strongly about this one. But supposing we are wrong on this point, the rules should still be overturned as an unreasoned abuse of discretion, because the commission's principal basis for the 180-degree policy shift is an alleged change in relative poll ownership, which the commission posits might impact bargaining leverage. Well, the problem with that is that there isn't any evidence in the record to support this shift, this supposed shift in relative poll ownership percentages.
It's the inference of a shift in, quote, bargaining power, unquote, from the change in ownership ratios that you dispute, not the change in ownership ratios.
No, actually, it's the change in ownership ratios that we dispute. And here again, it's what the record doesn't say that is more important than what the record does say, because there isn't any record evidence about a shift, let alone a dramatic shift in relative ownership from 1996 to the present. And in fact, the FCC identifies as its baseline for the supposed changes in relative ownership, 1977, which of course...
I don't think that makes any difference. In other words, if it's apparent now, when the commission, now or a year ago, whenever it was, when the commission is making its decision, that there is what the facts on the ground are such that inferring some condition of bargaining power, they presumably should go with that in the exercise of their discretion.
Well, for purposes of the argument today, we're willing to assume that the commission can make the leap from poll ownership to bargaining power. The problem is the data on the poll ownership. It just isn't there.
But I'm sorry. I mean, it sounds as if what you're objecting to is not a change from 1996 to the present, but you're objecting to the commission's reliance on a change from 1973, was it, to the present. But I have to say that they're using current data for an inference as to current conditions. It's hard for me to see that as a problem.
But they haven't done either here. They've misidentified the baseline as 1977 versus 1996.
Why don't you put that argument aside? Then the second one is?
Second one is that the data doesn't even show a shift in poll ownership.
Let's not worry about shift. Let's talk about ownership. So you say that the data they rely on for current pole ownership is not valid, is totally wrong.
We're not suggesting that. We're saying that the FCC's basis for the change was a shift in pole ownership, but that there isn't evidence of a shift. We're not disputing that the numbers.
They just read Fox. They don't, under Fox, they don't have to justify changing. All they have to do is justify the new outcome.
Well, but the data, there has to be some data. The FCC is indeed entitled to change its mind if it has Chevron 2 deference. And it doesn't necessarily have to have better reasons for doing so, but it still has to have good reasons for doing so. And good reasons don't exist where the data isn't there. It's not a matter of not enough data. It's a matter of no data to support the claimed shift. The second argument that I'd like to address relates to the FCC's new telecom rate rule. And in its new telecom rate, the FCC has, in essence, decided that the result in 224E should mirror the result yielded from the upper end of application of the 224D rate. We think, as with the ILEC argument, that this issue is actually resolved on Chevron Step 1 grounds as well. The principal argument upon which the FCC relies is that the term cost, as used in Section 224E, is undefined, unadorned, and thus ambiguous. But it is not undefined, and it is certainly not unadorned.
Where is it defined?
It's defined in two ways. First, within Section 224E itself, where it tells us that the cost at issue is the cost of providing pole space.
Okay. It's the cost. We know what it's the cost of, but we don't know what kind of cost, right?
But the first issue is important because we know from Section 224D that the cost of pole space is defined as the actual operating expenses plus capital costs of the pole owner. And so that's the important adornment for Section 224E.
Are you saying that it's adorned in D shows that there's a very strong inference to be drawn by the absence of adornment in E?
Yes, and because one thing that is not
to mirror the general approach of the Supreme Court in Gulf, whatever it is, Gulf Power.
The Gulf, I'm not sure I understood Your Honor's question, but I will address Gulf Power because I know that's something that you'll hear from the other side here. Importantly, Gulf Power didn't address how the rate is calculated under 224E. Gulf Power only addressed whether certain types of attachments by entities that nobody disputed were covered by the Act were entitled to regulated rates or subject to the FCC's regulation. Here, though, our argument with respect to 224E is, in essence, that Congress has defined cost in 224D, which is immediately above E, and by virtue of, as Your Honor suggested, not separately defining it, because it had already been defined in Part D of the statute. And one thing that we know Congress was doing in Section 224E is something different than 224D. We may quibble about what the term costs mean, but no one can credibly quibble that Congress was doing something different in E than it had done in D.
What is Congress doing in B1?
Yeah. In D1?
B1, B as in butter, 1.
B1 is the general devise of jurisdiction to the FCC.
And it gives authority to the FCC to assure just and reasonable rates.
Yes.
And isn't just and reasonable rates rather broad?
If we didn't have subparts D and E, it would be. And again, it would be a different case. But we have
some. What is the unambiguous definition of cost that you draw from D with a gloss of E or D without a gloss of E, whichever it is you're doing?
Yes.
State what the unambiguous cost is.
The actual
unambiguous definition of cost.
The actual operating expenses plus the capital cost of the entire pole, because E2 and E3 combined equal the entire pole. E2 talks about how we allocate the cost of the unusable portion of the pole. E3 talks about how we allocate the usable portion of the pole. You put those two together, you have the entire pole. How do we know what the cost of the entire pole is? We look at D, which tells us it's the actual operating expenses plus the capital costs.
And what the requirement of D is that a rate is just and reasonable if it assures a utility the recovery of not less than the additional cost of providing pole attachments.
That's the lower bound.
Nor more than an amount determined by multiplying the percentage of the total usable space, the percentage of total duct or conduit, etc. Right? That's the upper bound.
Correct.
So there is a bounds here, not a line, but a range, right?
In subpart D, there is.
Right.
In subpart E, there's no such range. There's one rate and one rate only. And it's a rate based on allocating the cost of the entire pole, but allocating the cost of the unusable space in a decidedly different way.
You're very emphatic about the application in E of language used in D, but I mean, if you're going to be focusing on that, what about the words actual capital? I'm not sure how much weight those words deserve anyway, but doesn't their absence from E create a problem for you?
Well, no. It is true that if the commission wanted to go back and redefine what operating expenses and actual capital cost meant, they might be able to do that. But that is not the case presented by, to the court today. There's a longstanding FCC formula that's been around since around 1978 that they use with specific FERC accounts and other inputs to determine the cost of the entire pole. And importantly, that remained more or less constant all the way up until the 96 amendments to the Pole Attachments Act, which brought us subsection E. And immediately after the 1996 Act was passed, while the embers of the legislative process were still smoldering, the FCC implemented E in a way that simply reallocated the same costs that were allocated in D. And there again, they didn't say, we're interpreting an ambiguous term. They simply said
it was clear and unambiguous.
They said the rules we adopt today implement the plain language of Section 224. If there are no further questions, to the extent I have any remaining time, I'd like to reserve
it for you. You have none, but we'll give you some back. If
thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Hear from the respondent first.
Good morning, Your Honors. It's become clear, something I didn't quite realize from Mr. Langley's argument, is that with respect to both of these issues, the telecom rate issue and the ILEC coverage issue, that the petitioners here are arguing that it is clear that Congress in 1996, when it added the coverage of telecom carriers to the Act, and when it added the telecom rate. In both these cases, it adopts statutory language that was clear, despite the fact that it was much more specific and focused than the language that existed as a result of the 1978 Act. In particular, let's look at the telecom rate issue first. Mr. Langley just said Congress was doing something different when it adopted Section 224E. Well, I would agree with that. Congress had, in Section 224D in 1978, had adopted a fairly specific definition of cost that it wanted the commission to use in implementing the cable rate formula. However, in 1996, when it adopted Section 224E, it simply used the word cost. And it, the commission was accurate in saying it was unadorned. It's adorned only if you read into the statutory text something that is not there, and in particular when you consider the long history of judicial interpretation of the term cost and the general nature of that term and the broad discretion that rate setting agencies like the FCC possess in implementing statutes that contain that sort of broad general term. It's hard to understand how petitioners can argue that when Congress adopted this statutory text in 1996, it intended to do the same thing as it had done in 1978, but with very different language. That simply doesn't make much sense to us. What the Commission did in exercising its judgment to make a permissible interpretation of this ambiguous statutory language Congress had adopted was to examine the occasion for the Commission to do this was Congress's language in Section 706 of the 96 Act establishing a mandate for the Commission to encourage the deployment of advanced telecommunications or broadband. Congress's subsequent adoption of language in the 2009 Recovery and Reinvestment Act that led to the Commission's detailed inquiry into broadband and adoption of the National Broadband Plan. These factors led the Commission to reexamine the implementation of Section 224E, which, as adopted in 1996, had generally led to a higher telecom rate than cable rate for attachment to poles that are essentially identical. No one, I don't think, argues that there is any practical difference between cable attachments and telecom attachments. And what the Commission did in reexamining the telecom rate as part of this proceeding was to adopt an upper bound of cost and a lower bound of cost, very similar to what Congress had done in the specific statutory language of Section 224D. And within those boundaries, there's no real basis to determine what the right figure is, whether it should be closer to the fully allocated cost or closer to what is essentially an incremental or marginal cost. And in keeping in looking at this, it's important to keep in mind that the utility pole owner recovers all of the costs caused by the attachment, the capital cost caused by the attachment, through the make-ready charge, which is all the costs that the pole owner incurs as a result of the new attachment. And in some cases, this can even include the entire cost of a pole. If the attachment requires the utility owner to install a new pole, that's part of the make-ready fee, and those capital costs are all covered separately from the telecom rate. But what the Commission did what the Commission did in adopting the cost definition as the input to the rate formula here was to make a determination that as between the upper and lower bound, it should adopt a percentage factor that would lead to a telecom rate that is lower and closer to the cable rate for a variety of policy reasons.
Say again the basis for that. The statute already discounts it by two-thirds, right?
Correct.
I mean by one-third.
Well, by the formula in 224.
Yeah. Yes, and what's the justification for discounting it further by the two different urban and rural rates, 66 and 44?
The justification for adopting a discount to begin with, and the Commission could have focused on the lower bound and made it an incremental cost, but the justification for selecting a particular point within the upper and lower bounds of costs was to approximate the cable rate as a policy matter.
Focus for a moment on that urban-rural difference, the 64-44. Where do those numbers come from? What's the Commission's justification for that?
The justification for that, Your Honor, is, again, the policy determination to lead to a lower cable rate.
Where I'll find the Commission's justification for those numbers?
I think if you look at paragraph 149 of the order, what the Commission says is that it's adopting these rates. The purpose of that is to, is to lower the rate and get it closer to the cable rate.
Are these arbitrary numbers?
No.
Where did they come from? I don't have the whole joint appendix with me, but I will during our conference later.
Right. In paragraph In footnote 453, the commission discusses some of the details.
Tell us what it says with respect to where these numbers come from.
Well, again, if I can just go back a little bit, there are a number of formulas that the commission's rules employ to determine the rate. It's not simply the statutory formula, and it's based on presumptions. And in non-urban areas,
isn't the commission bound by the statutory formula?
Excuse me.
Isn't the commission bound by the statutory formula?
Well, these are in addition to the statute.
Well, that's the question. I mean, if the statute says it doesn't just say cost; it says cost of providing space.
Right.
So when you deduct the 66, when the commission discounts it by or authorizes it, the 66 and 44, percent discounts, does that yield the cost of providing space?
Well, the statutory formula allocates the cost.
I understand.
The commission's determination is as to that pre-existing definition of cost, and the reduction factor that the commission adopted there's no dispute that it was result oriented. As petitioners complain, we don't think that is a criticism. That's simply
it was to make it equal to the cable rate.
It was to approximate the cable.
Well, why didn't the commission just say that?
I think the commission did say that. Oh. I think the commission said that a number of times.
I mean, why did it need all these? Why did it need the? Well, go ahead.
What the commission was doing was trying to reach this policy result within the statutory framework. And keep in mind that as Judge Williams noted, the overall policy here is the overall mandate of the commission is to adopt just and reasonable rates.
Yeah.
And the commission's view, not only would this approach adopt a just and reasonable rate, but it would have the additional benefit of carrying out the congressional mandate of encouraging the development of broadband and reducing marketplace distortions that had resulted from this different rates for telecom and cable carriers for which there was no economic justification.
My colleagues don't have questions on that.
No.
I'd like to question you about the commission's view of 224F. There's a paragraph in the order where, I guess it's a lot more than a paragraph, and it's a section that ends with a paragraph saying that the timeline, which is created by the previous paragraphs, does not apply except for the 45-day response rule to ILECs. Is that correct?
I recall the 45-day rule.
The blue brief called our attention to these items. But in a somewhat different vein. What I was left uncertain about was: does the commission have an explicit reason for 224F? We agree applies to telecommunications carriers.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
In words. So that presumably
right.
involves the exclusion involved
not
in the definition.
The commission concluded that okay. it does not apply to ILECs.
But ILECs are covered by sort of a tiny snippet of the timeline, right? Isn't that right?
Your Honor, honestly, don't remember, but I'll take – I'm not disputing you. I just don't remember.
I think it's the passage at page 22 of the – yeah. Right. It's there. No, I'm sorry. Maybe I'm misreading it. It's paragraph 40 of the order, page 22. And certainly, well, it appears that everything up to the last sentence is limited to telecommunications carriers and cable operators. Okay, then applications that are outside the scope of the timeline remain subject to the general requirement that the pole owner provide a specific written response within 45 days. Now, maybe I misread that. Maybe there are provisions relating to the timeline that the defines applications in such a way as what things are in its scope and what things are outside its scope. And I'm asking you very simply, does this mean that this general requirement referred to in the last sentence covers ILECs or not?
Your Honor, I honestly don't know the answer to that question. Okay. I can provide you with an answer, and Ms. Walker might be able to provide you with an answer on that. If there are any further questions on the telecom rate issue, just a couple of points on the ILEC issue. I think the issue here is whether it seems to me like it's very difficult to say this is a Chevron 1 case, as Your Honor's noted. We could spend a lot more time than we have here this morning discussing what the interrelationship between the 224 definition of telecom carrier and the general statutory definition, but it doesn't seem implausible that when Congress says that a definition applies for a particular section of the statute, that is different from what Congress has said with respect to how that term applies more generally. And in this case, in 1996, Congress added the term provider of telecommunications services in Section 224D and in Section 224A4. And in the next section, it added the exclusion of telecommunication carriers, exclusion of ILECs from the definition of telecommunications carriers. So this is clearly, it seems, a Chevron 2 case. And it seems, I think...
And your answer to the argument about means any?
I'm sorry?
Your answer to petitioner's argument about the means. Work means any does is what?
Our answer to that is simply that is a general section of the Communications Act definition that for purposes of 224... is overridden by what Congress specifically said in 224A4 and 5, none of the other arguments that are presented, the fact that they're not included, that they're excluded from the non-discriminatory access, the fact that this is unusual to have a rate regulation without access, none of those, as we discussed in our brief, provide any justification for their conclusion. This was a permissible interpretation of this provision. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Okay, we'll hear from the ILEC intervener.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Helgi Walker for the ILEC, the incumbent local exchange carrier interveners. We intervene solely on the question of ILEC's coverage under 224B1, Your Honors. A few quick points on that in an effort to be helpful. Mr. Langley was absolutely right when he said that this issue turns on whether ILECs are, quote, providers of telecommunications services within the meaning of 224A4, which defines covered pole attachments. But appellants never said, as he suggested here this morning, that the answer to that question was no. Rather, it is undisputed on the record before you that ILECs are providers of telecom services. What appellants argued was that B5, which defines the different term telecom carrier, implicitly excludes from the phrase provider of telecom service ILECs because they are excluded from the different term. As I think the court grasps, that's really not a plausible argument of statutory construction under general principles from cases like Rosello, which say that you have to give different terms different meanings when Congress uses them here so closely in the same statute, and also under the specific rule that they don't actually necessarily mean the same thing. So I'd like to turn to that.
So you don't agree with the commission that this is ambiguous. You think it's clear?
I wouldn't be earning my hourly rate, Judge Tatel, if I didn't ask you to consider our point of view that the statute's actually clear in our direction. Uh-huh. And Gulf Power supports that, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Justice Kennedy repeatedly referred to the plain language of D1, the coverage provision, and then A4, which defines covered pole attachments. He said he thought the entire court agreed that the statute was clear on its face. And we submit that the same analysis applies in this case. Judge Sintel, just as not every animal with retractable claws is a cat, so too not every provider of telecom service is a telecom carrier. The statute itself gives us an example of that. 153.51 says that aggregators of telecommunications services are not telecom carriers. So this is not, even generally speaking, a purely synonymous group.
Why doesn't the provision of one exception mean you're not accepting anything else?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand that.
It says it means, never mind, it's going to take longer than we're allotted.
If it's about the meaning of the word means,
it says means any and then it accepts something.
Means any.
It means any and then it accepts aggregators.
Right. Well, I think Mr. Pash answered that correctly, which is it's an interesting grammatical and academic discussion, but it doesn't actually matter here because in 224, I think the case can be answered within the four corners of 224, and this is the only statute that is directly at issue here, because whether even generally they mean the same thing, which I've tried to say they don't, they certainly don't mean the same thing in 224, mm-hmm. because Congress went to specific pains in 1996 to exclude ILECs from one term and then use an entirely different term in A4. Judge Sintel, you asked why Congress might have used two different terms in B1 and A4. One reason is that Congress might have thought that it wasn't necessary for telecom providers to have a non-discriminatory right of access under F, Judge Williams. I don't know if this goes to your timeline question. We don't dispute that we are not covered under F. We do not claim rights to non-discriminatory access.
What's your understanding of paragraph 40?
Candidly, Your Honor, I was not prepared to address that this morning. We'd be happy to file something supplemental on that. But it may answer your question that we don't claim any rights under subsection F. We recognize we're excluded from the term telecom carrier. But Congress might have thought that we didn't need a right of non-discriminatory access under F, but we should have just and reasonable rates when we do attach under B1. Why does that make sense? Well, for the first 18 years, that's exactly how the statute worked. Cable companies had a general right to just and reasonable rates under B1, but there was no provision on non-discriminatory access at all. That was...
That does raise a question in my mind. The utilities were thus free to stiff them. Is that right?
Well, Congress can legislate and...
No, I understand what Congress can do, but I'm just wondering how it worked out.
Well, I think it makes some sense. But F grants a right of non-discriminatory access. You might think that under B1, just and reasonable rates, terms, and conditions for access might include a general, perhaps not unreasonably discriminatory, right of access. Indeed, one might, and indeed we may be here later arguing that. But for today's purposes, I think all that matters is we don't
think there's... I was thinking about the access aspect of it as opposed to the non-discriminatory aspect of it.
Exactly, right. I think we have argued below that we think B1 actually subsumes that type of a right for ILECs, but that's not at issue here today. My point simply is that it's not irrational to sever non-discriminatory access rights from a...
It's only relevant in a sort of perhaps academic way, but we do a lot of academic stuff here. Why have a different treatment in 224F if, in fact, both non-discrimination and access are covered in 224B?
Perhaps Congress in the 96 Act wanted to give special and especially clear protections to telecom carriers and cable systems. If I might, on pole ownership, Judge Williams, you asked what the evidence on the record is. There was ample evidence, JA-774, JA-639, JA-194, comments of Verizon, AT&T, and the utility's own white paper that they submitted on that.
Is that on the Mr. Langley was very concerned about the change, if any, between 96 and the present. Did those data go to that period of time?
There's a Georgia Power chart that's also in the joint appendix that shows the historical changes from the 1980s through the present, so certainly would show the time range that he claims is relevant. In any event, Judge Williams, this is important. The FCC made clear in the order that it's going to test the existence of relative bargaining power on a case-by-case basis when it comes to ILEC. So the commission made a general inference that there had been a shift in bargaining power, but they're also going to test that on a case-by-case basis. If there's nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. I think we've gone well past your time. This has become our habit.
Thank you, Mr.
We'll hear from the non-ILEC interveners. Really forgotten who they are.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Nectarline for the non-ILEC interveners, and I'm here this morning to discuss the telecom rate issue. I'd like to address a point that Judge Tatel brought up earlier about the 66% and 44% figures that you see in the just and reasonable rate. But in order to address that fully, I think we have to lift the hood up a little bit and look at what is underlying these rate formulas. Ultimately, there are two different rates that the FCC adopted for the telecom rate. There's the so-called just and reasonable rate, which contains the 44 and 66 numbers. But there's also the lower bound rate, which doesn't contain those multipliers at all. The difference between those two and the difference between those two collectively and the prior telecom rate is a difference in how the FCC treats capital costs under the formula. There are two broad categories of costs that we have to focus on here. One is maintenance and administrative costs. 100% of those are recovered through any of these rate formulas. The other variable is capital costs. These are classic joint and common costs. There's no economically correct solution to how they should be allocated. The FCC concluded on the basis of this record that pole attachments cause no capital costs on the part of utilities. Those are already recovered through make-ready rates. It decided, though, that because there's no economically one correct solution to the how capital costs should be recovered, it would pick a midpoint, even though it would have the right to adopt the lower bound rate, which excludes capital costs altogether. It decided to pick a point in the middle, and the point that it picked is the one that is calculated to reduce the economically irrational disparity between the cable rate and the telecom rate. Remember, these are all the same attachments. The only question is what the signals are that are going over them. The electric utilities are making no arguments that they incur greater costs when telecom services are provided over these facilities than cable costs. It is a point of consensus that this is an economically irrational disparity. The National Broadband Plan found that that disparity had been hindering broadband investment, and the FCC thus reasonably concluded that it would allocate capital costs in a way under the just and reasonable rate formula to produce a narrower gap between the cable rate and the telecom rate.
I take it there was some reason they couldn't just say the cable rates apply to all providers of telecommunication services.
Well, in fact, that's not precisely what they did do. What they chose is a 66%.
Right, I know, 66.
And by the way, this is not a discount.
But isn't that to approximate the cable rate?
It is to approximate the cable rate in a very specific set of circumstances, but there is still variation in what you pay depending on how many other attachers there are on the poles. There is, in fact, a pending reconsideration petition before the FCC that would have the effect of actually replicating the cable rate in all circumstances. That's not, however, what the FCC adopted here.
Anyway, no one's complaining about that for us. The failure to adopt simply the cable rate.
Correct. That is correct. There are no further questions.
There's questions. Your time is passed, and we'll give 2 minutes back to the petitioner for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just one very quick point in rebuttal on the ILEC issue. In Helvering versus Morgan's Inc., the U.S. Supreme Court said, and I quote, "Where means is employed, the term and its definition are to be interchangeable equivalents." And that is our entire statutory point on the ILEC issue. Now, with respect to the telecom rate issue, there was never really a clear answer about where the 66 and 44% came from, other than that's how we get to the cable rate. That's the answer. Those percentages are not tied in any way to the costs that everyone recognizes are at issue here, and those are the poll costs. In fact, quite the opposite.
Are they any different for cable and telecom?
The cost to attach?
Yeah.
No. Well, no.
Okay.
They're not, but the point I was going to make is that the FCC was focusing on the cost to the attacher to make the attachment. And whether that is economically a sound analysis or not is not at issue here, because the statute in 224E just won't allow it. And so what the FCC really says is, well, we don't need to worry about that, because we actually have redefined cost in the alternative telecom rate. But they've done so based on the principles of cost causation. And Section 224E itself tells us that the principles of cost causation do not apply. Why? Because in E2, it allocates the cost of the unusable space, which the FCC itself says is not caused by the attacher. If there are no further questions, that's all I have.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Give us recess.